Welcome to the 11th and last lecture of the spring session of the Vancouver Institute for the year 2000. It's a session, I think, that has had many enjoyable speakers and only one truly untoward event other than my tendency to walk away with speakers' speaking notes sometimes, but I got over that. But Dr. Clark missed one of our meetings. That's because his family imprisoned him on the occasion of his 80th birthday, but he says that will not happen again, and he'll be here. He has asked me to offer you this bit of doggerel. When it comes to choosing institute guests who can be counted on for the best, our heartfelt thanks to Peter Nemetz. I think the thought exceeds the quality of the doggerel, but it's the thought that counts. The new program, the fall program of the Institute, will begin on September 16th. Sometime in the next few months, the printed program will be available. I can tell you that we're ending this session with a writer from the Globe and Mail, and we're going to begin the next session with a writer from the Globe and Mail, Mr. Jeffrey Simpson. And that will be on September 16th. I remind you again of the importance of memberships. $10 for students, $20 for individuals, and $30 for families. If you sign up now, and the desk will be open after the speech, your membership will be good until this time next year. I should mention there will be a coffee and cookie reception in the lobby this evening to add to the evening. And I should also mention the fact that the book, The Vancouver Institute, An Experiment in Public Education by Peter Nemetz, is available with a $60 or greater donation, and it is well worth that price. This evening, our speaker is Mr. John Stackhouse, who admits to having been born in Toronto, and who was educated in Ontario, took his degree at Queen's University. He is now the Globe and Mail's correspondent at large, based in Toronto, but covering a very wide range of political, economic, and social issues at home and abroad. His first book, Out of Poverty and Into Something More Comfortable, has just been published. It is not generally available, but the UBC bookstore will be offering it for sale in the lobby this evening, and I commend that to your attention. Mr. Stackhouse most recently has been reporting from Zimbabwe. I'm sure many of you have read his reports, including a front page report which appeared in the Globe and Mail today. He tells me he filed it from Zimbabwe on Thursday and has been traveling most of the time since to be here with us. Having joined the Globe and Mail in 1989, he was its development issues reporter in New Delhi in India for some 7 years, ending in 1999. He had worked for a time for other newspapers such as the Financial Times, London Free Press, and Toronto Star. He's won 3 national newspaper awards, 1 national magazine award, and an Amnesty International award. So I now have the pleasure of introducing Mr. John Stackhouse. Mr. Stackhouse.
Thank you, Bill. It's an honor to be here in Vancouver speaking about the end of development and to release my book, Out of Poverty, publicly. On first impressions, Out of Poverty may seem to be about a very different world than the one around us here at UBC. But it is very much about many of us here tonight and how we as Canadians view poverty, development, and human choice. And how the most interesting poor people I've had the privilege to meet view the same issues. It's also an honor to be here in Vancouver, especially here at UBC, because in many ways, this is where the end of development was carried out, at least development as so many had defined it. The AIPAC demonstrations of 1997 and the resulting fiasco exposed for Canadians to see right here on our own soil how a democratic government's friendship with one of the 20th century's most repugnant dictatorships could not only produce a flawed calculation of foreign policy, but a misdirected style of development and ultimately its demise. I raise the case of AIPAC because for a good part of the last 50 years, many Canadians, and for much of that time, most Western governments, believed that development could be directed and in places dictated. And in Suharto, we thought we had found a benevolent king, the embodiment of that ideology. It is breathtaking, I find it breathtaking, to stand here on the grounds of UBC a mere 2.5 years after AIPAC and contemplate not just the extraordinary changes which Indonesians have brought about since then, but how much the public's view of development has also changed. The end of development is what I will talk about tonight, not an end in the sense of Suharto, for his was the end of a temporal regime, but an end in the Eastern sense of the destruction that is necessary for a recreation, and also an end as the ancients knew it, that elusive and shrouded destination which we have been striving to reach all along. That we have reached modern development's end in its negative sense occurred to me several years ago, late at night in a mountainside hamlet on the western fringe of Pakistan. I had come to the village of Wiria, a few valleys shy of Afghanistan, with Abdul Ghaffour, a farmer and keeper of many lovely orchards, and a beneficiary in development terms of Canadian aid. In this tranquil hamlet, Abdul and his three younger brothers live with their three wives and their 42 children. The family's fertility in itself was impressive and an amazing story, and hardly the stuff of endings. But I was there to see a small dam the brothers had built with Canadian aid. The money came from CETA and was executed, at least in development speak, by a non-governmental organization called Refugees International, which always seemed strange to Abdul, since he and his brothers had never sought refuge from anything except the snow which was coming down upon us then. Logic aside, this was the very sort of development that the Seattle and now the Washington protesters this weekend see as the way forward for the poor. Very small, very local. It was also what the local provincial government was eager to see more of, especially since 2 years earlier it had spent more than its entire development budget on a new jet for the chief minister and had no funds of its own for this sort of activity. In my layman's eyes, the dam seemed good enough, but I didn't understand its limited consequence until nightfall, after the brothers and I had had a snowball fight in the orchard and moved inside. As we sat around a wood-burning furnace, drinking tea, playing cards, and eating a goat which they had slaughtered in honor of my visit, we got to talking about culture. Despite the many CETA and Canadian NGO visits to this outpost, no one had bothered to tell Abdul about Canada, or even sit with the brothers for a meal, which in South Asia is the greatest honor one can bring to a home. Abdul showed me photographs of the last visit when someone had strung a Welcome Canadian Visitors banner across his yard, and he asked why, if so many Canadians came to see his home, why he was not allowed to come and see ours. I'm afraid I did not have a good answer. So we went on to talk about children, which unfortunately proved to be more difficult, since Abdul was in his late 30s and had 10 children, and I was in my early 30s at the time and had none. What he hinted, as I tried to teach the brothers crazy eights, was my problem. I tried to explain our family plans as best I could, In our culture, I explained, many couples wait until their 30s to have children. My wife was busy working as a photographer. Moreover, I continued, we were trying to save, Moreover, I continued, we were trying to save money so that we could afford a decent upbringing and education for our children. In Canada, I said, children can be expensive. This was something Abdul understood. He had 8 children of his own in private school, which combined with his new Toyota pickup and recent pilgrimage to Mecca was getting to be a burden. The previous year, he had earned only $11,000, 20 times the national average, which was one reason, he explained, the Canadian aid was so welcome. But still, children were Abdul's greatest asset, each a gift from God, his strength, perhaps even his salvation. He looked at me again, perplexed. You mean you don't have children because of money, he asked. I again stumbled through my words, wondering if a financial calculation is what parenthood had become, when Abdul leaned forward and offered what, judging from his smile, was a very good idea. Why don't you go to this group, Refugees International, he beamed. They have money. They gave us money. They should give you something. You are from their country. They should help you. Then you can have children. I thanked Abdul for his advice and now have 2 children without the help of Refugees International. This was the way things were done in Wiria, where those who have are entitled to more. When the Sida Dam was completed, the water opened up new fields for cultivation and plots were allocated according to current land holdings. Abdul, with the new pickup and most of the village's land, got the lion's share of the new fields. The landless got none. I saw clearly then the disconnect we have in development, the horrible gap between the aspirations, understanding, and collective wisdoms of different peoples that neither time nor money has bridged. At the beginning of the 21st century, the voices on one side of this divide remain unheard, as frustrated as Abdul was in his desire to see Canada. I wondered, leaving Wiria the next day, that if 50 years of modern development had not given Abdul an equal voice in the world, or his wife an equal voice in the household, or Wiria's landless an equal voice in the distribution of new land, was it not time to bring an end to this era of development, little dams and all? I had to say yes then, and would say yes now, but for the reasons that may not seem obvious, and certainly not for many of the reasons raised by the dogmatic protests now underway in Washington. After nearly 8 years living in the developing world, I deeply respect what the official development movement has achieved. In New Delhi, our home during those years, I learned the importance of hospitals, highways, and hydroelectric dams, and most importantly, economic growth and the role that international assistance can play in each of these. In Biharipur, a remote village 330 kilometers southeast of Delhi, which I visited some 25 times and became very attached to, I came to realize the importance of modern medicine, schools, and agriculture reforms, and again the role for aid in each of these. Medical science, civil engineering, and monetary policy, to pick just 3 fields of intervention, have played important, though not always positive, roles in the great reduction of poverty in India and around the world over the last 2 generations. But if a more equitable and sustainable rate of human progress out of poverty is to be achieved in the next 2 generations, the 20th century's prevailing view of development must be succeeded by a more fundamental process of human beings everywhere gaining an equal and shared voice in the decisions affecting their lives. I thought again of Abdul a little over 48 hours ago, when I was standing in a maize field in northern Zimbabwe with a farmer named Stanford Machinga. His story is an inspiration for all those concerned with the developing world, yet it also reveals the complexities of human behavior, a field largely ignored by development practitioners, and it shows why social and political change must underpin any new hope for development. Late in the morning, Stanford led me through his fields, a modest 3 hectares, which in most of Africa would have consigned him to poverty. But here on communal land, land owned by the Republic of Zimbabwe and populated by its poorest people, who by the force of colonial history have to till the region's sandiest and rockiest ground. Here on this maligned land, Stanford had become the very model of development. He led me out of the maize fields, past a market garden of tomatoes and sugar beets, and onto a slope of sugarcane and banana trees that led right down to the banks of a local river, where without any assistance he had installed a system of pipes to irrigate his land. Stanford is known as a missionary farmer, one willing to experiment. At one time he used chemical fertilizers, but in the last couple of years he has dabbled with fodder trees supplied to him by the International Center for Research in Agroforestry, or ICRAF, one of those obscure international organizations that is quietly changing the farming world. The hundreds of small trees he has planted fix nitrogen in the soil. Their leaves, also rich in nitrogen, can be used to feed dairy cows, and when mixed with cow manure, can provide a rich nitrogen fertilizer. Stanford rarely uses chemicals anymore on his land, pretty much only to control pests, because he's making more money without them. His sugarcane alone earned him $1,000 US last year. He recently planted 700 avocado trees, added a piggery, and increased his dairy herd to 30 head. He has added cement walls to his small house, sheet metal roofing, and sent his 8 children to boarding school because the local school is so inadequate. Stanford could be the poster boy for any aid organization, and indeed he might, but for one problem. A group of neighbors have accused him of encroaching on fallow land between his homestead and the local school. It seems to matter little that the chief of the communal lands has ruled in Stanford's favor. When Stanford was away, raiders, he says he knows the men, killed all of his cows and pigs, leaving them poisoned in the open pasture. They're now threatening to burn his crops. I asked Stanford to explain this awful interpretation of justice and this miscarriage of development. He did not blame the World Bank, structural adjustment, or globalization. Jealousy, he said. It runs deep in the communal lands. Here we can see the importance of politics, very local politics, in what we call development, and why democracy at this very local level must be the foundation of any new approach to development in the 21st century. To understand how we got to this point, it's important to look at how the nature of development has changed since the mid-century, really changed quite significantly in a very short span of history. When we in the West talk of development, we usually take an unfortunately short-sighted view of it as being the post-war, post-colonial age of nation-state development, industrialization, urbanization, and the spread of modern or scientific agriculture. Although we like to view this world, our world, as pioneering, it was hardly the first time the world has witnessed rapid economic development or the large-scale international transfers of wealth, technology, ideas, and know-how. It was, however, the first time that most of the world's nations came together and agreed largely on a way to end poverty, indeed agreed that poverty could be ended. For much of the last half of the 20th century, there was an internationally shared belief in development as a formula, an end which could be achieved. Different nations and different blocks of nations had differing interpretations of this formula, but fundamentally there was a belief that nation states could direct human development, and more importantly, do so through international cooperation and multilateral assistance. This was unprecedented. I'd like to trace my own view of development for a few moments through the history of Biharipur, one of the places I know best. The village is home to about 800 people and is located about 3 kilometers off the main road. It has abundant fields and mango groves and little else. No school, no public health care, nothing that would resemble public action. But that does not mean it has been without different people's versions of development. The first signs of what we would call development probably came to this area during the Mauryan Empire, nearly 2,500 years ago, when a road and irrigation network was built across northern India, one which I suspect would rival today's overwhelmed infrastructure. The Mughal conquests and British colonialism introduced other styles of development. And for the first decades of independence, the new nation-state model was not significantly different, at least not to the tenant farmers. I wonder if they thought at one point of launching a campaign and calling it 2,500 years is enough. Eventually, though, land reforms, the most visible politicization of development perhaps anywhere, put my village on a different course. If only because, for the first time on record, the landlord and headman were one, a man from a lower caste who lived and worked in the village. This was equivalent to the smashing of Europe's aristocracies during World War I. As time passed, more nation-state development visited the village in the form of literacy programs, vaccination drives, and elections, but they were as hollow as the biogas stoves that broke as soon as they were installed. For the peasants, the landless peasants, change would not come quickly or easily. Indeed, significant reform, and with it the beginnings of a new development, did not come until recently, with the politicization of India's most oppressed people, the landless Dalits, or untouchables. When one of their own became chief minister of Biharipur's state of Uttar Pradesh, India's most populous with 150 million people, India saw the rise of a new enfranchisement, and with it, new political demands. This politicization of poverty was necessary to the new development, and it did not happen entirely on its own steam. In 1993, the Indian government introduced a profound constitutional amendment that empowered local councils, called panchayats, and these organizations have been around for more than 1,000 years. It empowered them with compulsory elections, financial transfer agreements with local states, and broad new powers over local development. Suddenly, these antiquated and largely powerless bodies had, for the first time, democratic influence over community development and accountability. Across India, the first panchayat elections were largely rigged, as they were in Biharipur, where my friend, the village nambadar or headman, Rajinder Singh Yadav, managed to get his wife, who lives in a form of purdah, elected to the County Development Council. He himself could not run for the seat, as he was a government employee, a school in a neighboring village. Nonetheless, he's attended every meeting on his wife's behalf, as has the son of the only other woman on the council. This does not cause me despair, because in thousands more villages, independent and conscientious women, laborers, and Dalits, in some cases all three in one, have taken their rightful place on local councils. Even in Biharipur, there is now an inexorable move toward community-based power. Rajinder's wife, I suspect, will not win another election. For much of the world, this was the story of the 1990s, not the internet or globalization or the spread of democracy through national elections. From Bangladesh to Ghana, the emergence of local democracy has changed the very nature of development. Of course, elections nationally or locally are not nearly enough to give people an equitable voice. Like Hitler, Suharto held elections. But even when elections are flawed, democracy can emerge. In India, local-level democracy is succeeding, albeit a rough-and-tumble success, because of other institutions and players who together form a vibrant public dialogue, often called civil society, that continuously draws in and amplifies the society's unheard voices. There are strong and independent courts, media that often show fierce autonomy from the nation's vested interests, and one of the world's liveliest parliaments, where national decisions, such as the Panchayat Amendment, receive serious scrutiny. India's great development challenge now, is to decentralize these forces in the manner that electoral politics has been decentralized, so that judges, local newspaper reporters, social activists, and provincial assembly members begin to see the disappearance of Biharipur's road maintenance funds as a public issue, their issue. There are already many movements doing just this, but I will focus on one. The Farm Workers Movement is an organization run by one of the most remarkable women I know, Aruna Roy, who quit the elite Indian administrative service in the 1970s to become a serious rabble-rouser in the northwestern desert state of Rajasthan. Her movement holds what she calls public information sessions, where local administrators and elected officials are called to account before their public. Thanks to Aruna's knowledge of the bureaucracy, village chiefs have been forced to read aloud the names of dead people still on public payrolls. In one village, a headman was forced to explain why half the allotted bags of cement for a new school had gone missing. The rest had gone to the construction of his house, he explained before resigning in disgrace. Aruna's public meetings feel like an Indian version of 60 Minutes, and they have infuriated politicians, contractors, and bureaucrats who see them as a burden on the development process. How ironic, because to many Indians, this kind of public management and accountability is the development process. This, I sense, is the growing belief across most of the developing world. Sadly, I cannot say the same of major development organizations, including at times and in places our own CEDA. At the local level, the belief in community participation, that people affected by development must be involved in its planning and execution, certainly prevails in much of the international development I have seen over the past decade. By and large, however, it has not moved beyond this, not across the chasm of faith to something called community management, where people affected by development truly own the process. Indeed, I would argue we in the West have not yet come to a point where development is even seen as a process, instead of a collection of programs, projects, and targets. When I was in the Democratic Republic of Congo 2 weeks ago, I was disturbed to see this lack of faith in community management in Canada's first major development project in the country since the bad days of Mobutu. Through Oxfam Quebec, CEDA is spending more than $1 million on water supply projects in two shanty towns on the outskirts of Kinshasa, the capital. Although the laborers on the project come from the shanty towns, there is little other community involvement, except for a small maintenance fund financed by user fees. The chance for a community, after so many years of strife and suffering, to set its own goals, raise its own funds, and design its own plans was lost. In Zimbabwe, where I went after the Congo, this lack of basic democracy and development can be seen at the root of the country's well-known land conflict. As farmers continue to live by a colonial model of land distribution and agriculture development. The concentration of prime farmland in white hands is only one aspect of the country's traditions of dictated development. Most black farmers, like Stanford, live on state-owned communal land without property rights or the right to speak in local decisions, which belong to a government-anointed chief or, as Stanford discovered, lawless thugs. Of course, as any farmer knows, land is just one element of agriculture development. Zimbabwe's small-scale producers must also endure an inefficient and corrupt government-run cooperative system, a government-run dairy network that pays them less than half the market rate for unpasteurized milk, and a usurious monetary policy that keeps imports cheap and indirectly taxes farmers up to 50% of the dollar value of their exports. A free and fair election, which Zimbabwe has never fully known, might bring some changes to these inequities. But what Zimbabwe needs in equal measure is a rethinking of its approach to development, in which, for example, farmers would be given control of their cooperatives. This is not an input like free land or an output like higher maize yields, but a process in which farmers gain a democratic voice in their own development. This hardly is radical thinking. Starting in the 1980s and gaining force in the 90s, aid donors began to see non-governmental organizations, or NGOs, as an efficient and effective catalyst for this process, which of course gained its own buzzword, empowerment. Unfortunately, the NGO movement has produced mixed results at best. My own opinion, and here I'm speaking in gross generalizations, is that NGOs provide an effective liaison with the poor and disenfranchised, much more so than the government organizations which they often displace. Some, like Aruna Roy's movement, can even be seen as change agents. However, they should not be confused with direct public action or authentic community management, which is usually best conducted through a government, a very local government. Perhaps the best example of an NGO's limitations that I can share with you is India's well-known CHIPKO movement. This movement started in the early 1970s in the Himalayan foothills, where commercial logging had surpassed any definition of sustainability. It was then that a local environmentalist decided to challenge loggers with a tactic that became an early model of what today big business would call eco-terrorism. The CHIPKO founder, Chandi Prasad Bhatt, convinced local women to put up the ultimate resistance to loggers by clinging to trees, thus the name Chipco, to hug. And soon the area's logging plans were laid to rest. The tree huggers had won. Bot went on to receive several national awards, international acclaim, and an abundance of domestic and foreign assistance to train more women to defend, protect, and enhance their environment. Having attended a Chipco training camp in the mountains in the snowy month of January, I was devastated to discover last summer that the original Chipcos actually never Chipcoed. The trees were never hugged, at least not in the face of chainsaw-wielding loggers. There was only the threat, and in politics, threats can be more powerful than actions. But in the end, it was a local politician who persuaded the loggers to back down. Now, as a journalist, I expose urban myths and rural folklore at my peril, for the facts in this case ruined a perfectly good story. But the discovery of this unfortunate version of events reminded me of how the renowned Chipcos had failed to include in their work the most basic element of development, which is ownership. This was clear to see when I first visited a Chipco camp in 1993. After an 8-hour drive from New Delhi, I met on the side of a mountain road a Chipco organizer who led me down a steep goat path across a suspension footbridge and up the other side, a mere 1,000 feet, to the village of Dwing. When I fell behind, the local man stopped for a cigarette and then proceeded again to race ahead of me. Finally, at the top, once I realized I wasn't in the middle of a massive coronary, I noticed a glorious orchard sprouting an indigenous orange-like fruit, and beyond it, a dozen boys playing cricket, as they do in almost every village in the subcontinent. Except here in Dwing, they were using the round fruit for balls, smashing each one into pulpy pieces with great delight. This added new meaning to the term sticky wicket, I thought, and then began to consider the economics of the game. There was no worry about supply, for behind the bowler was a mound of fruit large enough to last them a good many innings. A local woman explained there was no practical way to get so many bushels of fruit down the mountainside, across the footbridge, and up the other side, certainly not when their only customer was a state-run fruit growers cooperative, which came down the road only sporadically and unannounced. The women of Dwing, I was told, were not involved in the NGO's original market assessment or in the fruit cooperative's management. As in the original Chipco threat, they were merely actors in, rather than authors of their community's development. Let me stop here for a moment to summarize the ground I've covered. For the past half century, national governments have provided a useful, necessary, but ultimately insufficient model of development. Multilateral and bilateral aid has largely buttressed that effort. More recently, NGOs have been recruited or volunteered to fill the void created by government failure. And in many instances, but certainly not most, communities of the poor have been engaged to carry out development activities from which they are to benefit. But local control of and responsibility for public action, building a school, for example, has for the most part been wanting. Development, it would seem, remains an interventionist activity rather than an internal process. Should the failure of external assistance to promote greater change through both official and non-governmental challenges be used, as so many would like it to be used, to radically change the system of international development? Should we, as so many would like, close the World Bank, scale back CETA's mission to humanitarian concerns, and leave the world's poor to sort out their own differences, tap their own resources, scrutinize their own government, and manage their own change, in short, to author and publish their own development? No. The de facto end of official development assistance to Burma, Sudan, and recently the Democratic Republic of Congo should tell us, until recently, the DR Congo, that is, should tell us fairly clearly what happens when aid ends abruptly. But let me stress the positive. Across the developing world, there are countless examples now of effective community action, enough for me to believe that local democracy is today moving our world forward. And in the best cases, international assistance is easing the process. The most compelling example I know of is taking place right now in the most awful part of India, as perhaps it must. In the 10 worst districts of Bihar, the worst state in India, the education system is being transformed, even revolutionized, through the most disruptive force known to schooling, the Parent Teachers Association. In the district of Chhatra, a district I visited last year, there has been little resembling government since a Maoist insurgency known as the Naxalites took control of the countryside, murdered or scared away all the big landlords, and frightened state police into their barracks. In the ensuing void, the Naxalites have tolerated, even encouraged, a remarkable education reform designed by the national government and UNICEF, and implemented by a new autonomous state education society, which oversees and trains teachers, builds and renovates schools, and transfers school management funds to local PTAs, whose parent members are elected by each village. The PTAs have the power to discipline teachers, select and modify elements of the curriculum according to local needs. In Chhatra, for example, seed varieties have replaced India's space program on science exams, and set the school calendar and hours according to harvest needs. The state government, venal and corrupt, has been effectively shut out. Whether the reforms are producing better educated children will not be known until independent exams are conducted. But really, such outcomes are secondary to the process itself. Between 1994 and 1999, school enrollment across Chhatra nearly doubled, with the greatest gains recorded by girls. Most importantly, the oppressed villagers of Chhatra have started to gain a voice in their community's development. For those who doubt the role of national government in the so-called age of globalization, consider that it was in the Indian government, elected and accountable, that got these reforms going. For those who doubt the effectiveness of international aid in a world awash in private capital, consider that it was UNICEF's autonomy and credibility that brokered the reforms in some very troubled places, which by no coincidence is where poverty tends to be deepest. And it is now the World Bank, arrogant and ineffective as it can be, that is financing the expansion of these school reforms across India, home to nearly half the world's out-of-school children. The bank-led $1 billion district education program in northern India, which is also supported by the US and British governments, and of course the Indian government, may well be the most significant expansion of education the world has ever seen. These reforms are doing more than educating children. They are seriously and in some places radically changing Indian democracy, and with it, the nature of development. Of course, it's hard to argue against any of this, but we must ask if this remolding of development in a more political, democratic, and decentralized form is enough to save the world from the greater ecological pressures, from resource scarcity, population growth, and growing conflict as human demand races ahead of Earth's supply. Is an elected village council or a PTA enough to keep us from reaching the crossroads, as Woody Allen once put it, between sheer hopelessness and utter despair? No, it is not. I cannot stand here tonight and say that most of the world's poorest nations and communities do not face extraordinary and unprecedented resource shortages. Ethiopia today, with 60 million people, is on the brink of famine. In 30 years, it will have to feed twice that many, 120 million people. Bangladesh must get by with close to 1,000 people per square kilometer, three times as many as present-day Japan, with less industrialization than Japan had a century ago. If you read today's Globe and Mail, you will know Madagascar is losing its natural diversity at such an alarming rate that it could lead to mass extinction of species on a global scale. Local-level democracy, at least on its own, will not halt these crises. Scientific innovation is needed more today than 50 years ago. Better management of our own consumption certainly would also go a long way to easing global pressures, while external resource transfers, what we know better as aid, can play a very useful role in easing pressures on natural resources stemming from poverty. But in designing this assistance, we must be careful not to assume a linkage, at least a direct linkage, between poverty and global pressures, and thereby misunderstand, once again, development. I say this because the poor too often are blamed for global problems, Deforestation is a common example, when they are not only not responsible, but often hold the solutions that elude us, the affluent. The poor do not destroy their forests. The poor do not migrate en masse, at least not to the West. The poor do not start wars. In most of the world's poor communities, there are sophisticated and tested systems of resource management and conflict resolution. Trouble usually arises when the poor lose traditional access to those resources and are pushed onto non-traditional and usually ecologically fragile lands, forests, and waters that others do not want to populate. Sometimes this is because of their community's own population growth, an unfortunate outcome of medical science and greater survival rates, I concede that. But for the most part, they are marginalized by the population and consumption growth of other communities. In the northeastern Indian state of Nagaland, which borders Burma, traditional slash-and-burn agriculturalists were blamed for years for the rapid reduction of forest cover. The state government went so far as to ban it, to ban the traditional practice of slash-and-burn agriculture, that is. But then researchers started to discover that the roots of the problem lay with outside logging interests. An increasingly corrupt state government put and kept in place by the Indian government to quell ethnic unrest, and by the increasing militarization of the state. Guess what? Armies use trees. Over the last decade, though, Canada's International Development Research Center, or IDRC, has taken a different tack in the state, working with slash-and-burn farmers to restore slash-and-burn agriculture as a way of protecting forests. As a result, forest cover is now returning, and through a better selection of tree varieties, local farm incomes are rising. Astonishing as it may seem to some people, when the poor are put in charge of their lives and livelihoods, they tend to move out of poverty. I agree this view in its raw form is naive, ignoring as it does the growth of populations and their consumption and the shrinking resource bases that I mentioned earlier. However, the Nagaland experience shows how research and technological advice, when applied to traditional resource management techniques, can have a positive effect. Looking ahead, one of the world's great challenges is to graft technological innovation and financial assistance to the necessary social change needed to promote justice and equitable development. Helping Stanford Machinga raise more dairy cows will not bring about lasting development if his communal lands remain a hotbed of conflict. New schools in Bihar will remain empty if villages around them do not resolve their caste differences. I worry this message is too often lost in our own public discussion of development, which at a government and non-government level seems preoccupied with global issues, perhaps because in our vanity we see ourselves as global people. We see Nagaland's deforestation as a global environmental threat rather than a local political problem. I'm reminded of P.J. O'Rourke's memorable line that everyone wants to save the world, but no one wants to help mum do the dishes. Whether we like it or not, the coming years will be very much about doing the dishes, because metaphorically, that is what Stanford Machinga, Aruna Roy, the PTAs of Chhatra, the women of Dwing, and the slash and burn farmers of Nagaland are doing. Trade, investment, Kyoto, and the IMF matter a little to these people, but not a lot. For them, the local struggle to gain and share power is the great challenge of development. This sort of struggle was well underway the last time I was in Baharipur last July. The people whom I counted as friends had turned on each other in the sort of class battle we in the West tend to applaud when we see it in Zimbabwe or Bihar. In a village I had begun to think of as my own, I felt more ambivalent, perhaps because I knew the relationships and circumstances were more complicated than a black and white sketch of wealth and poverty or power and oppression. The fight over the location of a new school was tearing the village apart. Not because of the school, it was a mere proxy for a greater struggle for control of land, government patronage, and votes. It had led to at least one murder, accusations of rape, and considerable property damage, and caused me to deeply question my own understanding of development and its relationship with democracy. As I left the village, though, I thought about how this struggle fitted Biharipur's own troubled history. The Mughal emperors had driven the communities of northern India inward, The British had patronized local princes and created impermeable layers of bureaucracy. And the governments of independence had failed to deliver so much as a school or single paved road to this community of 800 people. I have to believe the young people of the village know these issues all lie in the past, and that their community now lies more than at any time in history for them to shape. Can they do this together democratically? I'm not so sure. To do so, they must reorganize their very society or face more violent conflicts. But with mitigators like Aruna Roy, with advice and help from outside organizations ranging from the local administration to the World Bank, and with local knowledge, that is, the awareness that now reaches the farthest corners of the earth, the awareness of other societies resolving conflicts peacefully, and here I would mention Senegal's recent democratic transition of power, which I think every African I met on my recent trip knew about. With all of these factors, this sort of social and political transition, and with it the reallocation of power, need not be violent, especially if the larger forces decide, as they did in the case of Bihar's schools, that this is what tomorrow's development is all about. It now is tomorrow in Biharipur. At this hour, the sun will be high over the sugarcane fields, where women will be busy pulling weeds and watching out for snakes. The men who have not cycled off to the local market town will be repairing their farm implements or dozing as I usually did on Sunday mornings under a mango tree. April is like that in the village, the month of marriages, glorious and peaceful, the transition between a cool winter and punishingly hot summer. Amidst this tranquility, I have no idea how the village will resolve its most fundamental challenge. But I do know the voiceless are now being heard, as they are more and more across the developing world. And they will continue to raise their voice, and this is not something we should fear. This struggle is not something we should view as an impediment to development, but as a necessary process that ultimately is development. And in this there can be no end, but only new beginnings. Thank you for listening and for sharing these stories, for sharing your concern for the people I've met and been able to bring their stories to you. Thank you, Peter, for inviting me to speak here tonight. It's been a pleasure.
Take questions. All right, sir.
The evidence from trade and investment over the last 20 years, not only in Latin America, although there are great examples there, but also in Southeast Asia and Indonesia, for example, is that trade and foreign investment does increase the gap between the rich and the poor. It does not make the poor poorer. It certainly makes the rich a lot richer, and it increases the gap. The fundamental problem I see is not in the trade and investment process. It's in the management of them and in what has become another buzzword of governance and how these societies, how these countries govern themselves. And in this, I would hope democracy would lead to change. The evidence from Latin America is that democracy does not produce quick change because the elites tend to control power, tend to manipulate power. That's been the example in Brazil, in Mexico, in Chile. However, with more decentralized power, more decentralized democracy, I have to believe that the elites who try to manipulate the system become more accountable to the people. Yes.
Summarize the question.
Yeah.
Sir?
Good sir. This weekend is an important conference going on in Cuba. But we simple meek Canadians won't care about it too, because we are so conditioned by the foreign, meaning USA media and the gross American street. Would you comment? And also, is the cousin were going to follow the Indian or the Chinese model.
Is your first question about the G77 summit in Havana that went on this week? Yeah, the G77 is the group of 77, just as Canada belongs to the G7 or now G8, industrial powers. This is the sort of third world answer to that, where leaders gather every couple of years. This week it was in Havana. It is an incredibly ineffective forum because they first of all, those countries have very little power internationally. Secondly, their leaders come and say things and then go home and do things that are very different. And thirdly, a lot of these countries have very little in common, Cuba, Zimbabwe being good examples of countries that belong to this movement but really don't have much other in common. So I wouldn't, if your question is about whether the G77 is going to have much influence, I don't know if that was the question, but I would say no. Well, sorry, if we're talking about Cuba and the world's understanding of it, certainly it's the United States' goal to isolate Cuba. The G77 is a different issue. But let me deal with your second question, because that's a fabulous question, and I don't have an answer, but I'll offer some thoughts. Yeah, the Indian model or the China model, that is the great choice facing the developing world in the coming decades. China is the great response, which critics of my arguments would provide to almost everything I've said. When you mention democracy, they say China. When you mention public participation, public management, they say China. Look at the reduction of poverty. Look at the improvement in living conditions in China. I've not spent a lot of time in China, so I can't speak authoritatively about it. But if you look at Indonesia as an example that was held up only 5 years ago in response to advocates of democracy, it's been an absolute debacle. And I think countries, developing countries, now look more positively towards democracy as being fundamental to development. And they see how dictated development, as in the case of Indonesia, can be ultimately disastrous.
All right, sir.
Yes.
How does the your so-called PA system work with that?
The question is the relationship between the panchayat, the elected village council, and the PTA, which is a different body. Often, they're similar bodies because, just as in our society, dynamic individuals want to participate in public affairs, and so they run for election, whether it's the panchayat or the PTA or some agricultural council. They want to be involved in everything, and they tend to get elected either because they have some dynamism, charisma, or personal influence. But they are separate bodies. The PTA has its own powers over the school. The panchayat does not have any powers over the schools. But the panchayat tends to deal more with public works, roads being typical example. In cases where the PTAs do not exist, the panchayats have control of a decision as to where to allocate a school, for example.
All right, sir?
Mr. Sakya, thank you very much for the illuminating talk. Thank you also for your columns over the years. They have been very rewarding to read. I was very taken by your faith in local level democracy. They're good stories, excellent stories. But you seem to sidestep some other major issues. You alluded to some of them in the context of India, both class and caste. The issues of gender, the issues
Is there a question, sir?
What?
Is there a question coming?
There is a question coming.
Oh, soon. for the sake of other people who want to ask questions.
I'm saying there are an enormous number of other pressures which compromise your faith in the local democratic way to ethical development, if you like. How do you balance the fact that there are enormous pressures out there of caste and class and other things which makes the little person little in the face of things that are enormously powerful?
Thank you. That's an excellent point. And I wouldn't disagree with you, except to say that I don't think these social pressures compromise the ability of democracy to bring change, but they certainly challenge the ability of democracy to bring about change. But here is where outside organizations can play a very important role in challenging, tackling fundamental social problems or barriers, gender being a classic example. If you look at Pakistan, for example, any local council, elected or otherwise, is all male. Left on their own, most villages in Pakistan would be run only by men, largely for men. External organizations, and this is not necessarily foreign organizations, there are certainly a huge number of Pakistani organizations working on this, can bring about change forcibly by offering assistance that's conditional on the participation of voiceless people such as women in Pakistan, or through more constructive measures such as trying to convince the local holders of power, namely the men, to bring in larger or to develop a broader representation of society in decision making, because that leads ultimately to better decisions. It's not a simple process. It's not an overnight process. It's something that would take decades to change in most societies, but that doesn't cause me to give up hope.
All right, Dr. Clark.
Thank you very much for bringing that up, because that that takes me to I'll repeat the question. Of these excellent examples of poverty eradication in the developing world, are there any examples that could be applied in Canada that we're not using now? That takes me to one of my favorite subjects, homelessness. As some of you may, or many of you may know, I lived on the streets of Toronto for 7 days in December as a homeless person and wrote a very controversial series of articles about this in The Globe. It was fascinating to see the reaction, positive and negative, to these stories. It was absolutely overwhelming, not only for me, but for the Globe and Mail. But in the discussion, One of the most interesting topics that came up was the issue of poverty reduction. And I was amazed to see in the social services that I encountered in Toronto, in shelters, food banks, emergency relief programs on the street, how they were all driven or managed by a handout mentality. And most of these programs, and I said this to people and always shocked them, most of these programs or projects would not receive Canadian government financing if they existed in Bangladesh, because Bangladesh is probably 10, 15 years ahead of us in terms of offering social services, in terms of the poor people managing, not participating in, managing these services. Some of the more successful agencies in Toronto have participation organizations working with Native Canadians living on the street, for example, employ mostly Native Canadians to do the work. But there isn't the management, the responsibility, and the risk in these organizations that you would find in Bangladesh, where the poor more and more are being put in charge of the services that are being offered to them.
All right, sir, at the back.
Yes, you.
The question is about the internet and New World Bank financing $500 million to help developing countries improve their capacity for dealing with the internet. This is one of the great issues now in the world of development organizations. And suddenly, most of the big development organizations are all gung-ho about the internet and feel they should be involved in financing and playing a role in getting developing countries on board. It seems intriguing to me that the internet, which is one of the great private, even though it was created, as we all know, by the public sector, but it's developed, it's mushroomed because of private sector involvement, not only in North America, in India, for example, the internet is spreading very rapidly because of private sector management. Why aid organizations suddenly feel they can play a role? They're going to be far behind the private sector, behind entrepreneurs in most issues, except perhaps helping governments enhance their own capacity on the internet, but I'm not sure that's a worthwhile pursuit. I'd be very skeptical, is my answer, about any public money, aid money, being put into internet development, because I don't see it doing anything that the private sector can't already do faster, more efficiently, more effectively.
All right, ma'am?
You raised the issue of the relationship between poverty and environmental liberty. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
So as people move out of poverty and become more developed, then they start to work on themselves.
Yes.
And I'd like to wonder if you could talk about, you have faith in this emerging democracy. What about recovery? You've seen a lot of environments, and especially urban environments. I'd like to know your thoughts about the prospects for the big cities.
The prospects for the big cities are absolutely disastrous. If you look at almost every example of urbanization in the developing world, it's just disaster after disaster after disaster. I lived in New Delhi for 7.5 years. I got a tear in my lung just from breathing the air. I had to give up running because I could barely run around the block without gagging. The air quality is that bad. And it's getting worse every year. And there is no reason that every other fast-growing city in the developing world, from Kathmandu to Harare, isn't going to go through the exact same development, which is serious, severe environmental degradation before. There seems to be now a proven relationship that at a certain level of economic development, then cities start to have the resources, communities have the resources to invest in environmental technologies. So when you get up into, you know, a few thousand dollars per capita income, then cities start to clean up their act, as you see in Southeast Asia, in a lot of cities like Kuala Lumpur, even Bangkok, which is becoming a lot more livable than it was 10 years ago because Thailand and Bangkok are a lot richer than 10 years ago. But that doesn't give us a lot of hope, because most countries are still in the sort of $500 per capita range of income. If things go well economically, then you know, they're heading straight into disaster zone in the next 10, 20 years. I have no easy answer to that, except to bring in the point about democracy, that my observation is that municipal governments, when they are directly elected by the inhabitants of a city, tend to be more responsive to environmental pressures. New Delhi is an interesting example. It's not a state, but a union territory. Its government used to be appointed and controlled by the union government, the national government. But in the 90s, it changed to become a city government with councillors and a mayor elected by the people. That government was a lot more responsive to the environmental concerns of the citizens, such as polluting buses and taxis, which have now, last month, were ordered off the road to be refitted, because that is an electoral issue. People are voting on the environment as an issue. When the city council was appointed by the central government, it wasn't an issue.
All right, gentleman in the blue shirt.
I have a question about international aid organizations. Mm-hmm. For the past 10 years, they've been talking the talk and walking the walk, and how yet, you know, you describe a process of development that's very intensely local and political. So there seems to be sort of a major gap between these folks sitting in New Delhi or Harare versus what's happening in the ground where they want to channel their resources to the best potential.
Yeah.
How does one even start reconceptualizing their role in this new, you know, process that you're talking about?
This is...
What was the question?
I'm sorry. The question is, how do these giant global aid organizations like the World Bank and IMF, I assume you're talking about, meet the needs of local communities that are trying to develop democratically, or these local political movements that are very local? So you've got global resources, local ambitions. How do you bridge that? That is the fundamental challenge facing the World Bank. It is trying to reinvent itself, even though it is a multi-billion-dollar organization with programs, lending programs in 150 countries around the world. It's trying to recreate itself as a more locally responsive organization so that it can finance or channel money into local organizations such as the PTAs in Bihar. The World Bank money goes into this statewide autonomous education society. That society then can distribute the money to the PTAs to do as they choose. That's about as far as the World Bank has gone. It's certainly not far enough, and I'm not sure whether they really can kind of move down to a more local level. I think in their best intentions they're trying to, but as an organization, that's a hugely difficult task.
Now, in spite of appearances, Mr. Stackhouse is not immune from the jet lag that arises from 9-hour time differences, so I'm going to ask for two more questions. The gentleman back.
What do you think of the idea of making microcredit available to peasant women, and have you come in contact with any organizations that do that, such as the Grameen Women's Bank of Bangladesh?
The question is about microcredit, especially to landless women. The example given is the Grameen Bank in Bangladesh, which is an interesting follow-up to this question about getting multilateral global aid down to the local level, because the World Bank has channeled a fair bit of money into organizations like the Grameen Bank, and it's trying to do a lot more of this to essentially puts seed capital into a bank working with local people, and that bank or lending organization on lends it to people. Yes, I've spent a fair bit of time with the Grameen Bank in Bangladesh, as well as a lot of other microcredit organizations, actually in several countries. What do I think of it? I mean, the Grameen Bank has largely been successful, but it has not been nearly as successful as it claims to be or as its supporters think it is. The reduction of poverty in villages in which the Grameen Bank is active is not significantly different from the reduction of poverty in non-Grameen Bank villages. It's still not understood why this is. There's a very interesting study, just as an aside, by a University of Manitoba PhD student who lived in a Grameen Bank village for a year in Bangladesh, and he's a Bangladeshi by birth. He found a disturbing increase in domestic violence against women, women who received loans from the Grameen Bank. Because what happens in most microcredit situations, not only the Grameen Bank, I've seen this across lots of other microcredit organizations, is that the women are a front for the men, similar to the panchayat elections that I was talking about, where a man can't get elected, so he puts his wife up, and then he goes to the councils and makes all the decisions. So the women become a puppet or an actor, and this has happened far too often in Grameen Bank cases, where they get the money and immediately turn around and hand it to their husband, who then invests it or spends it as he chooses. Then when time comes around to repay it, she has to get the money from him. That creates tension and leads to domestic violence. However, I mean, that leads to a question then, should this approach to microcredit be abolished? And I think the answer, certainly my answer, but also this PhD student's answer, and I think most other people would say no, that's not a reason to abolish the system, but it is a reason to change the attitude of the lending organizations so that the lending officers become more aware of the social situation in microcredit. It's not just a financial deal that you're making, it's a social issue that you're dealing with, and a lot more consideration has to be paid to that.
All right, sir.
I think I see a pretty strong link between the question is about the link between local democracy or politics, national democracy or politics, and international politics, and whether I'm perhaps naively viewing these as separate entities that have no connection. I don't think that's the case. I think there's a very strong link, often too strong link, between local democracy or local politics and state or national politics. If you look at the Bihar education example that I talked about, there you have a program created by the national government, created by a national political agenda that sees primary education as an important voter issue, and local community-based elected bodies carrying out or executing the work. There's a very important connection there. But in a lot of developing countries, there's a very important issue as to whether local politics should be politicized in the way national politics is. Do you have national parties running for local councils? That's a very, very dangerous process, because in most countries, then local politics becomes not a channel for development or a forum for development, but a forum for vote, gaining votes for the national parties.
Will you take one more?
Sure.
Yeah, all right, one more over against the wall. Yes, in the gray.
Radio. Radio is, and I'm sorry, I don't mean to be frivolous, because she raises an excellent point about the internet and information in its effect on democracy. It's obviously having a profound effect, which we really are only beginning to understand in our society, what effect will it have in the developing world where so few people have access to the internet. My response is radio. Radio is a fabulous medium, been used for decades to communicate ideas and information, used widely, almost universally, in Asia, in Africa. You would be hard-pressed to go into any hut in Africa that does not have access to a radio if they don't have their own radio. And that's how things like Senegal's election and the peaceful transition of government get to communicated to so many people across Africa. And I think in our enthusiasm for the internet, we shouldn't forget simpler, older media like radio, like print, which are used by the majority of the world's population are still very important. Now, are we going to create an unbridgeable divide between our wired society and the unwired world? I don't know, but you're not going to have villages in India or Africa wired in the next 5 or 10 years, because they're not going to have electricity in that period, and they're not going to have telephones, and they're not going to have the education for these. There's now a lot of talk about leapfrogging, which is an old development idea which is pretty dangerous and has never sort of produced great examples of success, whereby we believe other societies can leapfrog the technologies that we've used and suddenly jump into the 22nd century. People talked about that 20 years ago, and not a lot of countries leapfrogged into the 21st century at that time.
To thank the speaker, I call on Dr. Bert Alsop, the Consul General of Ghana.
Mr. Chairman, distinguished speaker, and members and friends of the Vancouver Institute. As we look to this program, for April the 15th, we saw with some apprehension that we were coming to the end of the spring series of lectures. However, no such disquiet or worry was attached to the subject of the lecture, nor indeed to the speaker. Most of us have followed the well-balanced columns that he has written in the Globe and Mail, and thus we looked forward with glee and anticipation to the viewpoints he would be discussing. We were indeed not disappointed by Mr. John Stockhouse. Vancouverites are indeed keenly interested in the issues of international development. Very many are involved in NGOs, and indeed in this audience tonight there are many who have been working at grassroots levels in CEDA programs, IDRC programs, and many other international agencies' activities. Accordingly, whether with the APEC conference with which you started, or indeed WTO, or many of the other things that were mentioned, the impact of development for the Asian, African, and Latin American countries are concerns which we have always voiced from this part of Canada. Whether by coincidence or by astute planning, John Stackhouse's lecture comes to us as a sort of precursor to the IMF World Bank conference of next week. In fact, he seems to have prepared us mentally and given us attention of the grassroots level of development rather than the big institutional decisions that are going to be made by the World Bank and its conference. I was looking at my notes and trying to make some notes. I've noted that he started and moved us from the UBC campus and our APEC demonstration to dams in Pakistan, to family planning, to Zimbabwe, maize, ICRAF, that international agroforestry issue, the politics of the landless in Zimbabwe, in Uttar Pradesh, vaccination, women's rights, etc., etc. Parent-teachers association, which resonates with many of us, Bihar schools, etc., Madagascar, Ethiopia, some countries which many of you may know, and others which are just names of interest. And indeed, the comprehensive answers to the various questions indicated the profound interest and knowledge, empathy and understanding in many aspects of development which he has shown. His masterly presentation has both educated and enlightened us, and therefore I feel persuaded that we are all exceedingly thankful for his presentation despite the jet lag. Accordingly, may I ask you to express your warm appreciation for this evening's speaker.